Good morning. This is Carol Steckler at KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. In your studio today with Bruce Krebs. And again, we are talking trash for the next hour. And I'm just going to play a little garbage music here to start us off with. There we go. Yay. Here comes Pete Seeger.
Mr. Thompson calls the waiter, orders steak and baked potato. He leaves the bone and gristle, and he never eats the skin. The busboy comes and takes it, with a cough contaminates it. He puts it in a can with coffee grounds and sardine tin. And the truck comes by on Friday, carts it all away. 1,000 trucks just like it are converging on the bay. Oh, garbage, 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 garbage. We're filling up the seas with garbage.
Garbage, garbage, garbage.
What will we do when there's no place left to put all the garbage?
Garbage, garbage, garbage.
Garbage. Mr. Thompson starts his Cadillac and winds it down the freeway track, leaving friends and neighbors in a hydrocarbon haze. He's joined by lots of smaller cars, all sending gases to the stars, there to form a seething cloud that hangs for 30 days. And the sun licks down into it with an ultraviolet tongue, turns it into smog, and then it settles in our lungs. Oh, garbage,
garbage, garbage,
garbage, garbage. We're filling up the skies with garbage.
Garbage, garbage, garbage.
What will we do when there's nothing left to breathe but garbage?
Garbage, garbage, garbage,
garbage.
And we'll catch some more of that later on. But right now, I'd like to introduce our guest. He's actually the one who told me about this, because along with many of the other things that Bruce's past and present brings to Lopez Island, he's a musician and has played with Chicken Biscuit. So, Bruce, whoops, let me get you on the air here. Good morning.
Good morning, Carol.
Yeah, it's really nice to have you here. Now, as I say, along with many other things, Bruce is one of the managing directors of the Lopez Solid Waste Facility here, and he's the financial officer. But we're going to start today with, and this is a rumor I've heard, we're going to talk a little bit about rumors today and dispel some of them and confirm some of them. So I'm guessing this will be one we'll confirm. And that he and his wife, Sheila Simpson Krebs, are master recyclers. So what's the story there? How did you get on this path, and what are some of your secrets, Bruce?
Well, actually, that is a myth. I won't say we're master recyclers. And how did I get on that path? Gee, I don't know what brought me here, but as long as I've been on my own, I've always tried to consume as little as I can and recycle as much as I can. Most of what we do, most of our practices are similar to what a lot of people do in their house or in their life. We avoid any single-use disposables. We don't get styrofoam cups and containers or plastic bags or utensils. If we go out to dinner, we take our own container instead of getting a doggy bag or a styrofoam container, bring any leftovers back. We recycle everything that we can, which fortunately on Lopez, that's quite a long list now since the dump has a very expensive recycling program. We buy food and supplies in bulk when possible, and when bulk's not available, we choose items that have minimal packaging, and even then avoid items that have any non-recyclable packaging. Obviously, we use recycled shopping and produce bags and reuse them until they're no longer serviceable, let's say. We have a wood stove for heating, so any of our lowest grade paper material, like egg cartons or soiled paper material that couldn't be recycled, or our low grade materials like ice cream containers or things like that, we use that as starter material. We buy locally to avoid the packaging for in the shipping, and when we do mail order, we order from suppliers that don't use excessive or non-recyclable packaging. We try not to buy things we don't need. I'm saying we here. I really should speak for myself. Sheila's good at it, but I should be speaking for myself, so I'll change that right now. I try not to buy things I don't need. I have a business, so I've got a lot of things to run my shop. But lately, I've been thinking much more carefully any time I go to the store and buy something. I'm not talking about food. I'm talking about consumer goods. Do I really need it? Can I get by without it? Can I find a used one? We give away any goods that are still usable to secondhand stores or take it or leave it to keep them in the system, keep them out of the garbage. I tend to wear clothes a little longer than most people would. And I guess there may be, that may be something that not doesn't apply to everyone, but for me, I can get away with it here on Lopez. In the market, there is a glut of fiber and clothing, and so even though we take our things to secondhand stores, it doesn't all get used, and a lot of it gets landfilled or maybe cut into rags. In any case, there's more than can be used. Interesting little aside, I went to some friends for dinner a couple weeks ago. It was a lovely dinner, and I noticed we had some beautiful cloth napkins that had holes in them, which I thought was just great. These are probably, you know, napkins that they'd use for 10 or 20 years. Maybe they had some sentimental value. I think if I got rid of all the things that were kind of old and shaggy in my life, I wouldn't have much left, since I'm getting kind of old and shaggy myself. Let's see what else. Oh, I looked up something. Speaking of fiber, I looked up some statistics on a cotton T-shirt. It takes a third of a pound of pesticides and 257 pounds of water to make one cotton T-shirt. And
if can you say that again? That's amazing.
Cotton, it turns out, is one of the most water and pesticide-intensive crops in the world, and it takes a third of a pound of pesticides, which weighs more than the shirt, and 257 pounds of water to produce that, if you track the whole cycle of that T-shirt. So if you wear that T-shirt an extra year or two, then you can stave off some of those costs. If you have a shirt that has some screen printing on it, and certainly that's been dyed and bleached, there's some other air and water pollution factors that go along with that. And if you're wearing synthetic shirts, it's not any better in terms of petroleum and pollution. So there's my pitch for wearing things a little longer.
Wow, and buying less.
Yes.
Both.
As I mentioned, buying used things when available, it doesn't actually reduce your garbage output, but it keeps a viable used product market going, and that in itself keeps the garbage or collective garbage down. I have the luxury of being able to often choose things that are better made. Often they cost more, but these are things that might be more serviceable in the long run. They're worth keeping. You know, if you go to a big box store and buy a $79 bike, you're going to throw it away in 5 years. And if you go and spend $500 for a nice bike, this is something you can service and use forever, as long as you live. And that's true of a lot of consumer goods, but not all. As an aside, I'll point out that I got up yesterday morning and hauled out a clothes washer that we bought 10 years ago that we thought would last us forever, a beautiful front loader that saved energy and water, and the thing went out on us. And I tried to get two different places to repair it, and after they told me that it would cost more than a new one, I still said, "Will you repair it?" And they said no. So we ended up buying a new one that hopefully has addressed the problem that this early model front loader has. But there are a lot of consumer goods out there that are just destined. They're just taking a little stop on the way to the landfill at your house. And if you can pick one that'll stay in your possession longer and can be repaired, that's a good way to keep your garbage loads down.
There must have been a washing machine, a gnome or something on Lopez, because our washing machine, which was used about maybe 15 years ago, quit. And so we took it to the dump, cost $22, and then went to the recycling place on, well, not recycling, Appliance Connection in Mount Vernon, bought one for $150. And we, too, are hoping that it will last forever, although none of those are, you know, the newer models that save water and have less use of resources, mm-hmm. all resources. So that's the other side of the same story of, and it's so difficult to decide which, I mean, we didn't have the option of buying a new washer, but even, and actually, we've never bought anything new, not because they, sometimes I totally agree with you that to make those purchases, they can last a lifetime, and yet we've always bought used and have had very good luck with that, but that's two sides of the same, just two paths, I guess, that have different impacts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised to hear that that brand new machine only lasted 10 years. I mean, we haven't heard the stories on all those. That's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah. One of the mechanics said he was surprised we got that many years out of it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's shocking.
Yeah. You know, when you think about how easily we buy and throw away a computer, it has to have had some effect on us collectively in a mindset that we would buy this consumer good that's $1,000 or so and we'd use it for 2 or 5 years and then we'd throw it away. And
yeah.
So we're much more likely to do that with, you know, maybe your parents bought a toaster oven and it lasted them forever. And we're much more likely to just toss things out after 5 or 10 years because
yep.
we've gotten used to it with computers.
Right. And vehicles, too. I have to say with cars and maybe we don't toss them out, but we have it, not me personally, but culturally, we have a tendency to want something better. Same with computers. We don't often get rid of them because they don't work anymore. There's just a better model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so computers might be an opportunity for us as individuals, for some individuals. If you have a business where you rely on a certain type of software or a fast connection or something, you can't run on an older model. That's one thing. But a lot of people go out and replace them just because there's a new one out there, and the one they have is still working fine. So there's just like a T-shirt. If you can get another year or two or three out of it, there's a good way to reduce the waste stream on that.
Absolutely. Do you have any other options?
Well, we don't put any food or plant material in the garbage, in my business, I use all recycled materials for shipping. I go to some length to get big, heavy cardboard panels that I use for shipping my wood products. The little clean, free boxes that you see at the post office are pretty tempting, but a lot of people have shelves or cupboards full of boxes at home that work just as well. And, again, if you can get a second or third life out of something like that, why not? So, like I said, nothing profound. That's what we do around our house.
Wow, and that leads me to a whole lot of questions about you, because this part of our interview is just I want to find out more about. So what is your business?
It's called Notable Woods, and I source and cut specialty woods for musical instrument makers, mostly guitar and ukulele and some mandolin and violin family.
And you ship that all over the country, I take it?
I'm embarrassed, thoroughly embarrassed to say I ship it all over the world.
All over the world.
I just rode my bike trailer to the post office and shipped 84 pounds of ukuleles to Japan this morning. A lot of the wood I use is koa, which is endemic to Hawaii, where I grew up, and ukuleles are traditionally made, 95% of them are made out of koa. So people in other parts of the world find me. If I had my choice, I'd sell to people on Lopez, and we'd all be making our own instruments, but the market doesn't work that way.
Absolutely. And I happen to know, because I knew it before I saw you ride up in your bike, that you rode here from the South End, which is about how far? You ride your bike every place you go, I know.
I try to. We live actually up by the ferry, so I don't know what that is, maybe 6 or 7 mile ride.
Yeah, both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. I've actually had occasion to, I think maybe ask if you could pick me up or something, and you've said, well, that really wouldn't work very well if you could find someone else because I ride my bike. And that really makes sense. It is. You didn't say you wouldn't do it if that was my only ride. I'd like to point that out. So I know you're really committed to those kinds of things. And I'd like to, you say you grew up in Hawaii.
I did.
Uh-huh. The other thing I wanted to talk about, well, like, there's so many paths I could go. How the heck did you get to Washington State? On Oregon first, I guess.
Yeah, I went to school at the University of Oregon for a few years and then ended up living in Eugene until about 10 years ago when Sheila and I moved up to Lopez.
Right. And while you were living in Eugene, I'm not a biker, never really have been other than just as recreational for when I was a child. But even I have heard about this bike co-op business in Oregon that I found out just recently. You were what? Were you one of the founders, or what? How did that work?
No, it was founded by a couple. It was called Burley Bike Bags at the time, and that's a misspelling of the word Burley. It was spelled B-U-R-L-E-Y, nicknamed after Beverly Anderson, who was a bike racer back in the early 70s when not very many women were bike racers. Actually, that's still true. And she and her husband started a partnership sewing bike panniers and backpacks, and then in 78 they converted it to a co-op and sold it to the owners, and I started in 82. We were down in Cottage Grove at the time. The business was, within a year we were down to four people, and we were essentially bankrupt. We had negative equity. So it was a bit of a grind to get the business back where we were actually paying a monthly wage and producing a product and distributing it in large numbers, which we were by about 10 years later.
Wow. And the business is still in existence, isn't it?
No. In 06, I left in 99, and in 06, they ended up selling to a local entrepreneur on a fire sale basis. They were near bankruptcy and they were bleeding. And he bought it and gutted the entire product line except for the trailers. He got rid of the bicycle lines, tandems and recumbents and road bikes and the clothing line. And we sold yurts for Pacific Yurts and wanted to focus on the trailers. And I'm not really sure why it took that turn in the last couple of years. But even in the 90s, when we were very strong, there were not many companies in the U.S. that were making bicycles. The whole industry had shifted to Japan back in the 70s and 80s, and then Taiwan in the 80s and 90s, and China, but you know, like everything else, by the mid-90s. And there were just a handful of bike factories still. We couldn't buy any of our components. We bought the very last tire from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, that was made in the USA in the 90s. And so I think Burley probably suffered, you know, that trend of taking manufacturing overseas.
Right, right. And what was your role with a Burley bike company?
Well, I got my hands into a number of things. As far as a job description, I was a general manager.
Uh-huh. And you also, what's your preparation for, I know you've been a financial manager or officer or treasurer or whatever you want to call it for the Community Land Trust, and now you're the financial officer for a sewer district. What's your preparation for that? Was something in Burley Bikes bring you the information and the knowledge to carry that out?
Just to clarify, not for the sewer district, but for the solid waste district.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And
right.
Actually, I need to back up even further than that. If I ever said I wouldn't pick you up because I ride a bike, I owe you big time, Carol, because I don't have a van to take you somewhere. But the next time you need a ride, if I can use your van, if it's midnight and you need a ride, you call me.
Okay, I will. And that's actually how people do it. When I go to a meeting, I actually ask if someone can pick me up. In other words, Al, I'm in a wheelchair for the Whistlers, the listeners who don't know that. And so they pick me up, and I have a van with a ramp, and they take me and leave their car at my house. So I'll do that, because we do go to meetings together occasionally. So anyway, back to becoming the financial officer, not for the sewer district, but for the solid waste district. What's your preparation to become that financial officer?
Well, who was it, Jeffrey Skilling in Enron, who said, I'm not an accountant? I guess that's kind of a scary connection there. But I am not an accountant. I don't have any training in finance. I took one business class in college just because I wanted to see what they were telling people, and that was enough to scare me off. But in the course of managing Burley and setting up the accounting systems, I needed to dive in fairly early on and fairly deep just to learn generally how they worked. And then in the course of preparing and managing annual budgets, we had a $10 million budget. You need to learn, grasp, and handle that with facility on a daily basis. And so whatever skill I got was learned on the job at Burley.
Yeah. Wow, that's really pretty incredible, because I know from sitting at meetings now and from your reputation at the Community Land Trust that you really are very skilled both at managing the books, so to speak, and also managing the human resources and interactions that go with being a board member on either a nonprofit or, as in this case, a managing director. So let's move on to solid waste here on Lopez Island and how you got involved with that. Where did that start for you?
It was probably a phone call from Sandy Bishop, who was on the there was an interim board that was negotiating with the county after the port had let loose on its exploration of taking over the dump. And she suggested that I might join the four others on the board, and I asked what kind of commitment she was looking at, and she thought it might be 3 hours a week. Al's laughing. And so I joined last May, and we worked with the county to create an ordinance to establish a new district and got our budgets approved, and then we had a lot of things to get ready for startup on January 1. Even though we were taking over a going enterprise, the county had been running it for 20 years, there was still a lot of things to work out.
Well, and the business model for the Lopez solid waste is very different than the business model that the county used, too. So let's talk a little bit about that business model, and then we'll go into some of the financial aspects for the community and taxpayers about running our own solid waste.
Okay. Well, I think most board members would candidly admit that it's a business model with a challenge, because our credo is zero waste. We want to reduce or eliminate all unnecessary waste over time. But our primary source of income is fees charged for garbage. So the more we succeed at our credo, the more we fail financially.
The less revenue comes through the door.
That's right. And so we need to counteract that. And the first thing we did was we wrote an ordinance, which the voters of Lopez approved, 85% in favor. I think the county attorney said that was the highest vote in favor, and considering the fact that it was for a new tax, we took it to mean that Lopezians were proud of their dump and they wanted to keep it, because it was definitely not the case that we would count on that facility being there if it didn't pass and if we didn't set up the new district. So we have our garbage revenue, and that as one component, and then we have our tax levy revenue, which amounts to about $100,000 a year. And then there's a third very important source of funds. SWAP, Solid Waste Alternatives Program, is a nonprofit that helps support us with information, materials, and fundraising. And so they collect donations and funnel those to us for use, both in the form of materials and cash. And actually, it's a four-legged stool. That fourth leg is the volunteers who don't provide cash, but you know about those volunteers better than anyone in Lopez since you manage them. And we have, 75?
Yeah, something like that. I'd say we have probably about 30 really committed volunteers that work at the dump on a regular basis, at least once or twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
The rest come occasionally.
Right. So these are people that are making an enormous commitment, not of cash, but of their time. And it's essential when we expand all of our services, as we did January 1, in terms of recycling, and in terms of trying to make improvements or to sustain the take-or-leave-it operation, the volunteers provide an essential role. So those are our four sources of revenue or
absolutely
income.
And, you know, the interesting dilemma which you spoke of when you started this part of the financial base for the solid waste district here, that is, whose goal is zero waste, is that every time there's a new market found for what had been disposable materials, which just happened to us, and we're all celebrating it because we now can recycle every television. They don't go into the landfill anymore. Television, even printers, which is like breaking news. You got printers or all of the paraphernalia that goes with either of those. We can recycle now through Washington State e-waste program, and that is less money coming in the gate because those are some of the heavier types of garbage that we used to collect for. I don't recall what the fee was to get rid of a television set, but I'm guessing it was something like $10, $15, I don't know. And there's no revenue in those anymore, which is a huge celebration because those with all the damaging components and that were filling up landfills all over this country or sometimes being shipped out into the ocean and dumped are now being recycled. And yet, here we are still trying to get enough revenue in the door to operate the facility. And the same with clothing. A lot of that, the unused and essentially huge amounts of textiles, as you say, that we accumulate, even here on Lopez, it's astonishing the number of women's clothes mm-hmm. that we accumulate on Lopez. A lot of that used to go into the dump. Now it doesn't. Now it goes to a place called Buffalo Industries, and it gets shipped to China. Now there's, or not to China, I shouldn't say that, but to third world countries around the world. And if there's such cost and promise to all of that, that it boggles my mind. So what can, I mean, not just the revenue coming in our door, but the cost of the transport of all this. I mean, it's a huge issue that we haven't even begun to map in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
So what when you think about it, how do you think about all that?
Well, you raised a number of points. On the last one, I'm reminded of an article Michael Moore wrote 5 or 10 years ago where he basically dissed the recycling program in this country. Maybe he didn't believe in it, or maybe he was trying to make a point, but hidden in his, if you could read beyond the dissing, he made some good points, which is that the recycling tends to make us comfortable about what we are consuming and think less about recycling something than throwing it away, because we know it's better and it's going to get used. But when you take that television and recycle it, it's not all going to be reused. A lot of it's not going to be reused. And we're going to invest a lot of energy, a lot of the remaining fossil fuel on this planet, which is getting depleted very quickly, to move those things around to get to the place where some underpaid person will hammer them apart and pull out the good pieces. So as great as it is to recycle, it is a reminder to me that it is always best to avoid consuming things or to reuse things wherever possible, or to extend the life of that T-shirt or that computer or that television. Television's a great example because everybody's gone digital. So these beautiful televisions are coming in every day. And these are expensive and heavy products. And you're right, they would cost about $15, some of the big ones maybe $20 each. And up until a couple weeks ago, people were paying that to throw them away because we didn't want to stack them up to the ceiling and to take it or leave it. There's only so much demand for these non-digital computers, televisions. So now we have this model where we used to receive $15 a unit, and now not only do we not receive the 15, we have some costs now. Instead of the customer dumping in the bin, we have to store these things and move them around and load them on the truck, and the state program pays a pittance. So this is a good example of where our tax levy gets used, because there is no other source of funding for that kind of thing. We have just lost our garbage income on that television, and we have just started incurring a little cost moving and handling those things. Same thing with the surplus clothing you're talking about. So I guess I would say two things. As I said, as good as recycling is, if you can avoid consuming or extend the life of products, that's part of the solution to our garbage problem. And when we do recycle, and when we do as a dump expand our recycling programs, we need to make sure we have the funding sources for that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because everyone thinks of recycling as so virtuous, and it is. I mean, it's better than the alternative right now, which is to fill up landfills and Lord knows where they go. We just ship them away. And
I can tell you where they go.
Yeah, where do they go now?
The piece of garbage that you dump in the bin at our dump gets handled 8 times. Well, the first time you bring it to the dump. Then we have a beautiful truck that we bought recently that has helped us control our costs. It's cut our transportation costs by 40% or more. And it's a lovely truck if you like dump trucks. If your grandma drove a dump truck to church on Sundays, this would have been hers, because it's got low miles and it's in great condition. We take that truck and we take your garbage and we haul it over to Mount Vernon and dump it at the Skagit transfer station. That's step number 2. Then they take it and they compact it, crush it, and load it into these bigger containers, and they take them over to the rail yard in Mount Vernon or Burlington somewhere. And then these get loaded onto a train, and that's step 4, and then transported on a 12-hour train ride 380 miles down to the Roosevelt landfill east of Glendale, Washington, on the Columbia River there. Then they get unloaded. I'm losing track. That's 4 or 5. And then they get unloaded and put on a truck and hauled up to the landfill and dumped at the landfill. And then the container gets brought back to the rail yard and gets brought back to us. So your garbage and its container that hauls it makes an 800-mile trip and gets handled 8 times. If you step outside of that picture far enough, you're going to see it's not a very efficient or very sensible system. But what it's called, they actually have a name for it. It's called waste export. Mm. And it's replaced the little local landfills. We have a landfill on Lopez, on Port Stanley Road, and most communities have their own little landfills, and most of them were decommissioned 20 or 30, 40, 30-some years ago. And this new so-called cost-efficient system, which may not be energy efficient or time efficient, is pretty much the dominant model in this country now. And this landfill has 2,500 acres, and it's a privately owned and operated landfill, and it has a life of 40 years, they say. Like Pete Seeger asked in his song at the start of this program, what do we do when the landfills are all filled? There is something to say about these large landfills. Most of them are lined to try and produce or reduce the contamination of the groundwater. And some of them have cogeneration, where they take some of the gases, methane and others, and burn that off and produce electricity. But it really is a messy business, and that's, I guess, why they call it garbage.
Wow. You know, I've really been only involved in the Lopez dump, or solid waste facility, whichever you prefer, for a couple months now. I certainly was one of the citizens who voted for this, and I've been a recycler. But once I got involved with the dump, I have become a much more intense recycler. I mean, I didn't used to recycle lids. Now I recycle lids, and I tear apart products. I mean, it's amazing the influence it's had on my personal behavior, mm-hmm. which impresses me. And also, I'm intensely involved with Take It or Leave It, because that's a very volunteer-intensive operation. And I see, and when I work there, because sometimes I work there as a volunteer, and I have to make the choices about what goes to garbage, what do we hand back to the person bringing it and saying, this has to go in your own garbage, what can we recycle, what can we put out for other uses. And, I mean, just on our little place and on my 2 to 4 hour shift, all those decisions are astounding to me. And I'd really like that you take all this right back to the consumer aspect, because it's quite clear and has been to me for a long time that that is the core. And yet, when I don't want to go too far in the woods here in terms of capitalism, but you know, really, that for capitalism to work, we need active and constant consumption of goods.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an absolute disconnect of our economic system that we operate in this country and how we can survive both as a community, as a country, and as a on the planet. And like I said, I want to go, that's not the weeds really, but it's a whole other arena. We should do a show about that sometime too. But you bring up in your personal story and in all the, and we'll go further into the finances of the operation, the absolute essential need to reduce consumer goods. And the other dichotomy of this is it's so difficult to buy things that are going to last anymore. I mean, do you find that in your, when you look at, when you absolutely need something, like your washing machine you just had to buy?
Mm-hmm.
How did you find one that was going to last more than 10 years, or did you?
Well, let's talk in 10 years, but I wanted to get one that had the highest energy rating, that is, it uses the lowest amount of energy. And it's amazing. And then, now here's an argument for making things and throwing away every few years, is because if technology improves things, then you don't want to be driving a 55 Chevy around when you could be driving a spiffy new hybrid. And so there is an argument for keeping in mind the efficiencies that come with the improved products. And so I wanted one that used very little water and had very low energy consumption. And then I made sure that the flaw that we had been addressed, or at least I asked if they had rearranged the bearing structure on that so the front didn't wobble and wear itself out in 10 years, and got some assurance that it would last longer and that it had been improved. But I, you know, if it lasts 15 or 20 years, who knows?
Right, right. If you'll indulge me for a minute here, I want to tell a personal story and give a happy birthday to my 90-year-old aunt in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, right outside of Minneapolis, where I was born. I didn't grow up there, but all my relatives still live there, and they're gathered there right about now, celebrating her 90th birthday. And we are of what's called the Walter clan in our family. And my aunt, who's now passed on, when she was visited us when she was in her, I would say, probably early 70s, and she told the story of ordering a brand new Ringer washer, and that she was the only client they had had for that. They still sell them, amazingly enough. And in that, and my father was, that's my my family of origin name is Walter. That was my father's name, Larry Walter. And they absolutely used things and repaired them and made them last. I mean, they didn't even look for things that lasted. They just made them last. They learned how to take apart everything. And not so much my aunts, but they absolutely, she had dial phones when, long before, I think she finally did go to a more modern phone, but not, they've never even held a cell phone in their hand that I know of, nor can I imagine that they would. And so it's a family joke about, I just grew up, that what you do is, you know, you make it last, and you always leave a place better than you found it, whatever that takes. And it's just part of the farming tradition, and coming from a Germanic background generations ago in the Midwest. And so to Aunt Myrna, happy 90th birthday this day. And bless you and all of the ways in which you've made do and made last your whole life as you walked everywhere, took buses when everyone else was flying planes. I mean, you are the model of responsibility that is lost in this culture. And just bless every day of your life for that.
What a tribute. I hope she gets to hear it.
I do too.
If we're lucky or clever as a society, we'll pass on her tips and her way of living to young people. A lot of people, young people are very thoughtful, and we don't always leave them with the best examples. You know, when you grow up and people are just consuming and throwing away stuff, that kind of becomes your norm. And when someone like your aunt can present an example, it gets them thinking.
Yep.
She's not just a Luddite or some old fuddy-duddy. We don't do it that way anymore. She's providing a model that can take us into the future.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so now let's dig into some of the finances at the Lopez Solid Waste Facility. I've heard rumors. I haven't personally heard them, but I've heard of rumors of going around Lopez that the solid waste facility is not financially solvent and probably won't last for more than a year. And I do go to board meetings. I'm not on the board, but I go to board meetings. So they're open meetings. Please come. Really interesting. If you're interested not only in solid waste, but how a small community can take on managing a solid waste facility. So, Bruce, you bring the information to the meeting that everyone has to figure out what's next and how's our revenue and how's our expenses. So how does it, and I will give one caveat, having started some new programs and put out some budgets without any actuals. And very seldom does the first budget match the actual because there's no model to work from. So we're 6 months into the first program, of the first year, with some actual numbers. How are we looking?
Well, all else equal, I prefer my rumors direct, but if all you got is a secondhand rumor from me, I'll take it. we're doing all right. The income is off by about a quarter. Our budget income, we're running at about 75% of budget right now.
And, in terms of revenue.
Yeah, in terms of revenue. And in large part because we had projected 540 tons of garbage, and we are running at about 410 or 20 tons right now if it keeps up at this pace. And so that income is actually even more than 25% off, but our whole picture has us at about 75% of our budgeted revenue. Our expenses are likewise at about 75%. And as a managing board, we have been dogging our expenses from day one, and we are carefully producing monthly statements. We produced a monthly budget, and we have spread out our expected revenue based on 4 years of county history so we don't have to wait until the year is over to know whether or not something needs to be fixed.
Yep.
We know that 12.2% of our garbage revenue historically occurs in July, and if we don't make 12.2%, then we need to address that, or if we make more than that, then we can enjoy that extra income. So we have been very carefully managing the monthly finances. We have statements within a week of the close of the month, so it's in due time. We can respond to whatever needs to be responded to, and as a result, as I said, we've held our costs down at about 75%. The problem with a new enterprise like this is that we have no equity. It's not like a private business where somebody says, I've got $100,000, I'm going to put it in a bank, and that'll be my working capital, and that'll get me through the ups and downs, and I'll pay all my bills on time. We started with nothing in the bank. Well, we got a bridge loan from the county to hold us until the tax levy money started coming in. But our challenge is to not only manage the declining revenue from garbage as we succeed in reducing waste, but to make sure we accumulate some working capital as quick as possible. And that's tough to do.
Yeah.
And we're doing fine. We have at the end of June, we had $105,000 in the bank, and $50,000 of which we need to pay back to the county. But our budget was $95,000, so we're actually sitting on some extra cash because of the careful management of the cash. So any rumors of our demise are premature, let's say.
Yeah.
We are healthy, and we're keeping a close eye on it. If we didn't have to worry about the market, or if we were not sensitive to the needs of our community, we would be looking at some price increases, or at least I would be recommending them to the board, either in terms of the levy or in terms of the per can fee. And that would get the revenue back up as the dollar volumes decline because of the tonnage declines.
And the tonnage declines partially related to new recycling markets.
Definitely.
It's an incredible kind of catch-22.
That's right. The more we succeed, the more we fail.
Yep.
And we just need to address that. We're just, as you mentioned, in a new enterprise, who knows what's going to happen the first year, and we were budgeting high. It's not to say our numbers are bad or unsustainable. It's just to say that we are below budget, and I expect next year's budget will be much more accurate, much closer to 100% as we address that.
Right, and better to budget high than low, because then you're dealing with a deficit and really no revenue source. So, and as the manager of the Burley Cooperative Bicycle Company that turned it around from bankruptcy to what, when you left, around a $10 million business, I have a lot of confidence in your capacity. You didn't create those dollars, and you're not creating the dollars that's going to make the Lopez Dump successful. But you're tracking them and making recommendations and setting up the books in a way that it's very clear for any citizen who would like to see where our money's going and where it's coming from. And I just have every confidence in your ability to do that, as did Sandy Bishop when she called and said about 3 hours a week. How many hours a week are you spending on?
Well, if Sheila's listening, I better not say.
Yeah, I know. I could tell when I called last night. Not too late, might I say. Mentioned that you were coming here, that I wasn't her best friend in that moment. I hope she's not listening. She'll listen to this sometime, and she'll forgive you and both of us, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's a lot, though.
Yeah. Initially, once we got things running, then the time commitment dropped way down. We also had the benefit of Neil, who had 22 years of experience and who has certainly got the driving vision, and Bob, who's been there for 4 years, starting on day one. So we were right up to speed right away. Yeah. We made some changes where we significantly reduced our transportation costs. We're using Lopez Freight to backhaul our recyclables, and that saves us money.
Right.
And it's also a very sensible way to, if you're going to burn up energy and use the roads, you might as well be full in both directions.
Yeah.
And
fill empty trucks off and bring them back full.
And it works out well for Lopez Freight. They don't make as much as they do bringing freight, but they make a lot more than running empty.
Yeah.
So operationally, we've got really good people that are volunteers and staff and board members that are, and I'm taking no credit for any of that, that are pulling things together and keeping the finances solid.
Right. And all of you listening on Lopez, and all of your friends and neighbors who bring things to take or leave it and bring your garbage to the dump. And there's one of the dilemmas that I know Reed talked about last week that's still true for us, as well as I would guess everyone across the country, is glass and the high cost of, because of the weight of recycling or dealing with glass, which there's a strong voices that say, let's have it be garbage. And there are other strong voices that say, no, not ever. So kind of, can you talk a little bit about that in terms of the finance?
Yeah, glass is a real sticky point for us. The last time I looked into glass, which was 30-some years ago, it was a cool packaging material. it was, you know, totally recyclable, and the materials that went into making it were readily available. But it is no longer the case. I saw something a while back that the market for glass is so low that nobody's paying. And, in fact, we end up having to pay somebody $60 a ton to take the glass, whereas we get money, a little money, for cardboard and tin and stuff to offset our cost to transport it. We end up, by the time we transport glass, we end up paying $100 a ton, which is approaching the cost of handling our garbage. And the market is just so down. I saw something that said that the city of Spokane had been stockpiling garbage glass, waiting until the market turned around where they could sell it. And they had the equivalent of a football field 9 feet deep of glass that they had been stockpiling. And
no market.
No market. And so we have been looking at alternatives to that, maybe using it for reclamation. But glass is probably our most vexing recycling issue right now, and there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
It's a high-volume item.
Yep.
If we look at our volumes for the first two quarters of the year through the end of June, we had 183 tons of glass, and the next that we moved, the next highest commodity was glass at 45 tons. So basically a fourth of our garbage volume we've duplicated in glass. And then right next to that, at the same weight, 45 tons, is mixed paper. So those two commodities we move a lot of. On the mixed paper, we don't have to pay $60 a ton. We get a small amount of money for it. And so it comes closer to break even.
And the use of glass just spikes in the summer as everyone, who uses a lot of glass in their business, like bars and restaurants and whatever, even private parties. I'm going to be really curious at the end of the summer. The glass is going to be an amazing amount of tonnage.
Yeah.
And compared to what the figures you have for the first 3 months of the year, for sure.
So here's a tip. If you want to reduce your glass usage, and if you drink beer, a couple days ago I did my afternoon bike ride down to Wattwa and back, and I stopped at the galley and I got a draft beer and rode home I hope there's no sheriff listening. Rode home the rest of the way, and I didn't have to use a glass, a glass bottle. But I don't know where that's going to go. Are you going to get beer? Well, you can get beer in aluminum cans, and aluminum is a very good material for recycling. The amount of energy that goes into recycling aluminum is 1/20th of the amount of energy that goes into producing it initially. And that sounds impressive, but I should also say it takes a lot of energy to produce it. But the point there is, once it's been produced, it's easily crushed and transported. It takes up no space and weighs nothing, which is not the case with glass, and there's a solid market for it. So what's going to happen to the glass market over time? Maybe manufacturers will start changing their packaging. You know, wine, I guess you can buy wine in a box, which means wine in a plastic bag in a box. And who knows if someday there'll be liters of wine in like a Pepsi plastic jug.
Yeah. If you'd have told me even 6 months ago, I would have been so fascinated by all of this information about where of recycling and the cost of garbage and where it goes and all the things we've been talking about, I would have been astonished. But I think it's really important for you listeners you don't have to remember that, like, how many tons of glass we had, but it's good to remember $100 a ton to get rid of it right now. And just remember the whole cycle of consumption from the time you have a gleam in your eye for either a new product or something that wore out that you need, and where that's leading all of us on the planet, especially those of us in this country who, I don't know the statistics, but per capita, we've got to be one of the, if not the highest consumer on the planet. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about?
I don't. I mean, we've probably all seen those pictures of an average American family with their average consumption a year next to a family in Kenya or somewhere, and it's startling, the difference. But and you put that very nicely. It's nice to remember that change like this doesn't generally come by being preachy about it. If, you know, if we make the facilities for people to conserve and recycle, and if we get the information out there, and if people, even if they don't make a complete life change shift, if they adapt or make some changes, that's when we start to solve the problem.
And I couldn't be prouder, as I'm sure you would agree, to live on Lopez Island, where 85% of us voted to tax ourselves, because that was the only way we could manage our own solid waste. Right. And it may be that we'll have to tax ourselves more if we really ever want to meet that zero waste. And for the day when maybe for 2 weeks no garbage leaves Lopez because we have such a little amount, we have to pay for it somewhere. We have to find a revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but believe in some way it's got to be us. So that's the good news and kind of the tough news, I guess. Not bad, but tough.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else you want to say in closing, Bruce, about...
Well, I think that show that you mentioned we might have someday about the costs that society, that capitalism doesn't fully address, would be a very interesting one. Mm-hmm. Because it's true not just in garbage. I mean, it's true in electricity. And there's this notion of externalities, these costs that are not included in the simple supply and demand formula because they are borne by society at large. The depletion of resources, the pollution of the air and water, noise, all these other ambient pollutions that we live with, they're borne by all of us in the things we consume. And that is definitely the case with garbage. And the garbage system in this country is subsidized to the hilt by governments because they don't want people throwing their own garbage in the water or the streams or the roadsides or creating their own landfills at home. So, it makes sense that it's subsidized, but it does mean that we're all paying for it indirectly.
Right.
And we're very disconnected from those costs as a result.
Well, I think that truly will be one of our programs, and I'll invite you back and maybe bring in Chalman and Chris Grecian, who look at these issues globally. And with the subject being capitalism and the disconnect between capitalism and zero waste and the consumption of goods related to... Well, I won't go any further. That's the subject.
All right.
I think that's a good idea. So you'll be back. Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is, I'm signing off. This is Carol Steckler at KLOYLP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And we've been talking trash with Bruce Krebs, the financial officer at for the Lopez Solid Waste District here. And I'm going to take us out with a little music. But if you want to know more and you want to get your hands on some of those recycled or take it or leave it materials, please call me at 468-2138 and volunteer at the dump. 2-hour shifts once or twice a month. It's great fun. You learn a lot. And have a good day. Here's some music for us to go out on.
Mr. Thompson calls the waiter, orders steak and baked potato. He leaves the bone and gristle, and he never eats the skin. The busboy comes and takes it, with a cough contaminates it. He puts it in a can with coffee grounds and sardine tins. And the truck comes by on Friday, carts it all away. 1,000 trucks just like it are converging on the bay. Oh, garbage, 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 garbage. We're filling up the seas with garbage.
Garbage, garbage, garbage.
What will we do when there's no place left to put all the garbage?
Garbage, garbage, garbage.
Garbage.